Tonight, a very, very difficult problem to deal with, which came up in conversation again for that ever-present threat, the nuclear war. But we're not going to deal with the nuclear war, but the likely effect of it upon survivors, and even those who don't. We have to discuss a very simple proposition in a very complicated manner. It's simple because it's to do with energy that is sentient. Now you all know, with your basic physics, that energy itself is indestructible. It may change form, but it cannot be eliminated. So if we say that energy must be sentient because we, who are made of energy, can feel. Sentience means capacity to feel. If we remove this capacity from energy itself, we have an insoluble problem. What is the relation of a non-sentient, non-feeling energy with the fact of sentience in ourselves and in the animal world? Now imagine the war has been fought, many bombs have been dropped, and a large number of people destroyed pass into another form. Their energy, wherever it is, still exists. But the energy of the survivors is in a very peculiar state of shock. You know how the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bomb shocked the Japanese and the rest of the world? It made them terribly sentient. It increased their awareness of cause and effect. This is what we're going to discuss. Under very big shock, threatening the elimination of our physicality, we tend to sharpen our awareness. So imagine after this very big shock, our awareness has increased so much that we are now aware that anything whatever we may do will have effects incalculable. It will spread out from the center of the cause throughout space because it is energy, and in the process it will discover effects produced far, far away, which are then reflected back to the causal center. This in itself is a very simple idea. Let's consider what it means. Supposing we all became aware that we are energy centers now, that every part of our body is a vibratory energy which is broadcasting to every other center of the universe, and all the other centers are responding to the received energy from us and sending back a reply to us. Supposing we become aware of it, let's confine it to this room. Supposing everyone in this room realizes that he is factually an energy which is broadcasting at various levels, the physical, the emotional, mentational, conceptual, volitional, to everyone. So that if we were to increase our sensitivity now, we would all become aware of each other's feelings about all of us, each other's thoughts, each other's assessments. How would you feel if you thought it was a reality? How would you feel if you knew that everybody knew your motive? Would you feel? Everyone would know everyone's motives.
It might be a great relief.
It might be a great relief. On the other hand, it might not. But I'm going to say categorically from certain experiments, this is not an empty theory, it is a fact. That at certain levels of our being, we actually do know each other's motives. And for peace's sake, deliberately suppress it, so that we can socially communicate With some degree, you have amicability. What are you smiling about this?
Because I know it's true.
Right. I imagine after that super shock of that great war, that Armageddon, we all become unavoidably aware of the multitudinous motives that everyone has without exception. Well, aren't the differences of motives differences of identification? Because remember, we are all sentient energy and nothing but. So the difference between one being and another is that with which that being identifies. In mystical terms, that which you love is where you place your chief energy, so that your loves, being different, fabricate you differently, physically, emotionally, mentationally, conceptually, and volitionally. Now, if it is a matter of identification only that distinguishes one from another, then the problem is, why identify in the first place? Supposing prior to creation, this infinite field of sentient power has not yet identified with anything at all. So it's just pure energy, sentient, feeling its own condition. Well, has it got a condition? Let's say condition means what it says together with its environment. The environment and each individual are in dialogue with each other, and that's condition. Now, let's introduce into this infinite field of sentient power, non-identified, and therefore nothing at all, because if you don't identify, you don't do anything, except merely be aware that you are sentient power, infinite. How do you feel like if you're merely infinite sentient power with no identification? Can anybody tell me how it feels?
That bliss.
Oh, good. That's what's called bliss. It's the bliss of non-identification. That's the Anand of Indian philosophy. The bliss of Buddhists and Hindus, and even of some Occidental mystics. When you break identification absolutely, you're in the state called bliss. Now the word bliss itself, prefix alpha, for musicians' sakes, alpha means hatura, the law. Now what is the law of bliss? The law of bliss is do not identify. Now if you don't identify, can you do anything in a state of absolute non-identification?
No.
And be careful. You might be able to do it. Move a hand like that. Do you have to identify with it to do it?
No.
Or can you do it without identification?
How would you know it was bliss if you haven't done anything yet?
You mean how would you reflexively, intellectually define bliss? That suggests that there might be a view that to know intellectually is a superior state than being in bliss. Yeah?
Possibly.
Intellectuals think so.
What's the difference between Carlyle then and Ananda? The Ananda's first movement.
Do you mean first in time? Or first prior to any creation?
Prior
to time. The difference is none whatever. There is no difference.
Can't you in a state of bliss be in a state of a feeling sense of being? No, not a being. You're in a feeling state, a feeling sense. Therefore, can't you in that feeling sense feel to other things?
Well, you already said you can. You don't have to identify in order to become aware, do you?
No.
You don't have to forget who you are.
No.
To become aware that the Saman sitting next to you.
No.
So in that state of bliss, it is possible to remain in that state and be omniscient.
Does that mean as long as you don't record it? Is it in the recording that then identifies it?
What's the matter with the mic? Bouncing again. And record would be memory, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Well, you could remember it without identifying with it. Yes? Can you remember somebody to whom you are indifferent?
Yes.
Well, then you've got a record of something to which you're indifferent. You don't have to identify. In fact, the concept of bliss in its true sense, ānanda, means an undulated emotion which has no content other than the flexing of the field. But it does not get hold of itself, grab it and say, I.
It's never crossed itself.
No. Mm. It's called Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew.
But wasn't it talking, was we, about it in that state?
You mean here now? Well, most people are identified here now, aren't they? So we're a little after the fact. But our conversation is in heaven. Means that we don't have to be in this condition. And we can get it now, if we prefer it. We can actually see without identification. If by identification we mean I get my teeth into it. Yeah? Appetite. And the moment you grab it, that's the dent, the teeth, the dentures. The moment you take your dentures out of the glass and put them in the object and write mine on it, then you have a problem that you didn't have before. Now we're going to use the letter K for this factor that grabs onto things and says to itself, mine. Appropriation. Making a thing one's own. Proprium means ownness. To appropriate is to make a thing by definition your own. It doesn't alter anything at all except in you, in your self-conception of your ownership. And remember, own means owed to the infinite sentient field. So an owner is holding things by permission of the infinite sentient, who is the real proprium of the absolute.
Could I ask you, is the no mind this, or is the no mind without objects totally?
No. The no mind is not without objects. It's a total misconception of the mind as a no mind to think that when you've got a no mind, there's nothing in it. All that is energy. Energy is sentient. It is indestructible and eternal, and energy is working. When that Jewish sage said, my father works and I work, he meant energy cannot, by definition, stop working. One lady up there mentioned pralaya. In pralaya is there no work. It's all work. But in pralaya, that's like deep sleep. Deep dreamless sleep. You are working to rearrange the energies of your organism in the light of your prior experiences. Is there no rest? Well, technically there is rest by the meaning of the word rest. It means being crucified by dealing with that which you've already done and trying to solve it. It's a very delicate problem, this, isn't it? It's the highest level of philosophical thought in any religion. What is the meaning of this bliss, this ānanda? All you do to draw ānanda is you do a wiggly line like a snake running along. The word anna means a running snake. And it means a snake that's not got hold of its tail in its mouth and made itself into a circle. And when it runs, it goes like this. One side of it is stretched and the other side is compressed. The only thing that makes it aware of itself as a self is that one side stretches and the other side compresses. It's this awareness of extension and compression simultaneously with it, because you can't do that curve and create the stretch on the outside without compressing the inside. Now the stretch on the outside reminds you of infinity. Get hold of one of your fingers and pull it hard until the bones in the joints begin to separate. You feel a funny feeling of voidity, won't you? Can you feel it? Don't be too kind on yourself. Pull. Can you pull your finger until the joint starts pulling apart? Now, I can feel it now, pulling my thumb. And the bones are separating, and I feel if I pull too far, I can pull it and stretch the tissue between and attenuate it. And how do I feel then? I push it back. Now, that feeling of potential voidity is a potential that cannot be reached because the energy cannot be destroyed. So the attenuation cannot go to infinity. It's only nearly. On the compressive side, you are egotistic. On the expanding side, you are omniscient nearly. To be omniscient, you have to be simultaneously aware of the stretched side, the compressed side, and the state prior to the compression expansion. The Sanskrit term spanda, S-P-A-N-D-A, means to stress and to expand. That means expand. That pansion in expansion. You know, pan means nature. Means absolutely all there is. If we were to stop this undulating process, we would become unconscious. We can approximate to it in deep dreamless sleep. And then what have we got as an object? Well, you can't say nothing because you are actually on guard. Because if somebody starts scratching at the window to get in, although you are asleep, you wake up. Whenever you are threatened, you will wake up, even from a deep sleep. So now imagine you have this power which is inherent in energy which is sentient by simply bending yourself a bit and becoming aware of extension and compression simultaneously. On the inner curve, you're an egoic being. On the outside, you are very, very nearly an infinitely wise being. You know, all simultaneously, when you look at the outside and the inside of the curve of that running snake. Now, how do you feel when you consider that actually you are aware of your egotism very, very strongly if somebody attacks you in any way, verbally or physically? Aren't you?
Yes.
What are you wearing around your neck?
Pearls.
Pearls. Are they real?
No.
Oh. It is an insult for me to inquire. You know, gentlemen don't do that sort of thing. Excuse me, get are those things real?
I don't feel it.
Or are they Marks and Spencers?
No, they were Woolworths many years ago.
That's the sign of what happens to you. You see, she got them even cheaper than Marks and Spencers. They may have survived from the time when it was sixpence for everything.
They were.
They were.
Yes, they were.
Good. Right. There was a record of a bargain. There is evidence. Providing Greta is telling the truth.
Oh, yes, I am.
And providing she's got a good memory about what the truth was. Because I remember a woman who had a priceless necklace of pearls, cultured, grown in Scotland. It was priceless, her husband didn't tell her. And she lost it. So she went and bought another one. And to this very day, her husband is proudly pointing to this, saying, when I bought that pearl, a real cultured pearl necklace, my wife, she was very pleased. It isn't the one. So his memory is the fault. I said, that's the main function of wives, to wake men up to possibilities. Now imagine we have all become aware that we are living in an infinite field of energy which is sentient, and we are all the insides of curves on our egotism side, and the outside of curves in our fear of voidity. And remember, because energy is eternal and indestructible, you can never become absolutely annihilated. You can only frighten yourself by a relative attenuation contrasted with your contracted egotism. Right? Now, supposing after that great Armageddon, we're all so sensitive, we're all in this room, mysteriously, we have survived. But we now see, without any difficulty whatever, all our motives intermeshing. What does it do to us? Two possibilities.
First thing I think is to make you very afraid.
Well, that's one point too. The other would be, like Deb said, could be a relief. In fact, everybody else is as big a swine as we are. Couldn't we? I mean, the word shrine, what does it mean anyway? A shrine with an iron in it. It means a one. Leibniz's monadic theory. The inside of the curve causes a spin. And that makes an egoic being. Unless you quickly let go of it and go on the other side and move to the next wave. And you can break identification and make identification every moment. Moment means orientation. In engineering, in architecture, moment means orientation. And orientation means turn to the sun. Turn to that which you worship as center of power. So you can orientate either towards fear, because everybody knows what I'm like, or towards delight. I know what everybody else is like, which I didn't know about.
Does that mean that then, that you'd be then going to the, instead of being the cause, which is the inside, the effect?
Are you taking the outside of the curve as an effect, and the inside is the cause?
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that, because the field itself has made the undulation inside out, outside in.
But the fact that you're trying to, when you were saying about moving to the outside of the wave, to catch the outside of the wave.
You know, what does it? Not the inside. Consciousness transcends the inside-outside polarity.
So be your initiative to jump on the outside of the wave.
Well, who is it? Did you say your initiative?
I said yours, I didn't say mine.
It's the field. The initiative is in the infinite field of sentient power. It's in the field. Now, if you don't identify with the field, you haven't got any initiative. If you identify with the form, you are mechanically determined by the form. You know that rule that we've said before? If you identify, you go under the law governing that with which you identify. You think you're a biped human, do you?
Yeah.
You think you're a rational being?
I don't want to come under identification of these concepts.
Well, whatever you think you are,
that's
if you identify, you'll find yourself obeying the law which covers your definition. If you think you're rational, which I know is not true, but I mean, if you think you are, you feel uncomfortable if you behave non-rationally.
It's the idea then to give yourself the highest values and then identify those highest values.
Well, I wouldn't identify with them at all. Why bother?
Aren't you going to feel that anyway? if you're perceived in my position, Will, aren't you in fact then beginning to identify with them?
Not necessarily. We've already proved that from Goethe's hypothesis. You can wave your hand without identifying with the wave, can't you? Now, if you identify with the highest there is, I know a few people in hospital who've been doing that. I actually met that thing you read about in novels about the crazy. A man that thought he was Napoleon. It's kind of a joke, isn't it? You identify with power. What was the name of that funny fellow in Africa who dressed himself out like Napoleon, had an imperial crown made, had a throne, got jewels, and the French put him in there, and then he behaved like a fool, and then they took him away again. They broke his identification. The danger if you identify with the absolute itself and forget the lowest level of the inner contraction, you lack humility. Don't you?
Yes.
So if you're going to identify, you have to do the trick of identifying absolutely with everything, which is entirely paradoxically contradictory. You're an absolute God, humbled in a fixed situation. That's the idea of the crucified God in Norse mythology. You know, not only in Christian thought, but in Norse mythology you have God crucified on a cosmic tree. You know, you have a nervous system. If you take it out, which you can do today with surgical techniques, and you can fill your places with resin and have a model of your nervous system, it looks like a tree, doesn't it? And you've got a thing in your head, in the brain, which is called the tree of life. It looks a bit like a tree. The circulatory system of the blood vessels looks like a tree, doesn't it? Now, tree actually means three. The word tree and three are the same word. Because it's force forming a function. That's what tree means. You start from a seed, you bifurcate it and keep bifurcating, and you're making branches, aren't you? Those are breaks. Black and branch. Yes? So that when you branch in this way, you give yourself a multitude of possible courses. You haven't increased the number of original sentient powers, have you? But you have pluralized it by bifurcation. If you identify with the outside, you feel nearly void. Some mystics love that state. They give up everything. They're just about to go bankrupt. And they give it up, the whole idea of it. And they sit there like this. And a psychiatrist comes along and says, you're a bit worried about going bankrupt, aren't you? And you don't reply. You've given it up. You make yourself as near to nothing as possible. A fairly good approach to that is the state called cabbage. Have you seen any people that sit there with their leaves nearly falling off and do nothing? I remember one particular case, she had 15 skirts on, one over the other, because she felt that if she got thoroughly dressed, nobody would know what she was like under the skirts. When they took her into hospital in town, they tried to undress her, because she died, poor thing. And her clothes did not peel off, they broke off. And the lowest garment they found was fashion 1910. Not bad, was it? And it was a bit crackly. And the nurses ran out, saying, "You do it." "No, it's yours. You do it." "No, I've done it. You do it." They were so kind of holding each other's noses. She was a noisome object. Now, identification means that you get your teeth appetitively into something and say, "Mine. I and mine are the real dangers." Now, you have a word J-I-V-A, jiva. Jiva means an individual identified with the body for developmental purposes. You have another word for a self, Atman, which does not mean identified with the body, but it does mean identified with a zone of consciousness in the infinite. But the name of the infinite itself is Brahman, which means the infinitely extended sentient power. Now, we are ultimately the infinite sentient power. Through various interests and identifications, which we'll call the K factor, we have brought ourselves first into a zone, Atman, then down, compressed into a body, jiva. And we are supposed to be fighting our way back towards identification with the Brahman. But if we do that without remembering the jiva, we'll simply go back into that state of pre-creational bliss. Now, actually, there is nothing in the universe or in any universe other than energy, and it is periodic. It oscillates between the infinitely extended, remember that's not annihilation, it's still sentient energy, and the compressed, individuated, body identified, same energy, but now identified, tied down by its own appetite. The name of that appetite is Maya. Now they translate that word Maya as illusion. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It doesn't mean I see something which is not there. It means I appetitively affirm something as mine. So cosmic Maya means cosmic appetite. It doesn't mean behind the scenes there is a divinity pulling strings to fool us. Nothing fools us except our appetite. Now, to make the thing even more complicated, remember, in a continuum that is not made of parts, the qualities anywhere are identical with the qualities everywhere. So if there can be identification anywhere, okay, Peter, do you recognize your name? Would you be prepared to defend it?
For a purpose.
For a purpose. Or to break identification, if I suggested that maybe somebody misguidedly had named you after either Peter, suggested Pope at some time, or Peter the Great, who had some very weird bad habits. One of which was to have chairs made with holes in them and make all male soldiers dangle their possessions so that he could walk behind and see they hadn't smuggled a girl in. And which would you rather identify with?
Well, not that one.
You see, you're preferential. Would you rather be a pope?
No.
Would you rather have bones under an altar waiting to be discovered by worshippers? You see how we tend to identify in the most minute thing. Right. Now, in fact, just as you are made of cells, or cells constitute you, but the field has constituted the cells which constitute you, so you've got 10,000 million brain cells. That's English estimate. The Americans are not so modest, they say 12,000 million. Like they count their football, it's different from ours. They like bigger numbers. Suppose we'll settle for the English, you've got 10,000 million brain cells. And every one of them, because of the law of the continuum, is as smart as the rest of them. And that means that a cell in your liver could have its own opinion and identify with liverishness. And a kidney could identify with kidneys, and a spleen with spleens, pancreas. Every single cell in your body is an individual with its own idea of reality, and it thinks when it identifies that the rest of it has been devised for its benefit. Yeah? Isn't that lovely? Under the sole of my left foot, I have a tender place. If I put my foot down on the ground, I'm not exaggerating, through my left foot I can count stones without taking my shoe off. That's a real fine extension. I can go on a pebble beach and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 under this foot. Check. My right foot does not do that. It's one of those insensitive, clubbish feet. Yeah. And every cell in the body has its own opinion about what the universe is about. And that's why it gets on with its work. Phagocytes in your body, white cells, think they're absolute super adventurers. They rush about like people on African safari, gobbling up bacteria, viruses, in fact anything. And even each other, one gets tired. That's their game. Right? Now we have to see. After the great shock, we'll all become so sensitive that we'll be aware of our K factors, that with which we have locked ourselves into identification. And we will pay the price of our identification. Supposing I became overcome with childish innocence, took off a shoe and hit you on the head with it now from a year, suddenly without warning, in a state of childish innocence. Nobody could blame me, could they? Not in a state of childish innocence. And the aim of all yogis is to reach that level where you could throw a battle axe at somebody, cut them in half innocently, without being unconscious. Very good, it's a marvelous state to attain. Some naughties, like say Alistair Crowley, have aimed at that as a sport, to get to that level of indifference. On one occasion it caused him to be chased by the police out of a situation he didn't want to leave. Well, he got identified with the inside of the curve more than the outside. And we don't want to identify, get our teeth into it. We just want to see the reality that is. And without identification, so behave that there is no comeback. And for all ordinary things, karma means cause and effect. But K-A-M-A is the Sanskrit word for Cupid. And it means lock yourself on appetite. Karma, that K factor again. And your ma is substantial appetite. Karma means cupidity, locked appetite. When you do that, you hit out and give contingent stimuli to other beings, don't you? Contingent means you touch them somewhere. And they then react and throw something back at you if they are in a state of identification, which most people are. And then you have to deal with the comeback. And for that relation, you put the letter R between the ka and the ma, and become karma. Karma is the relation whereby locking on an appetite produces an effect that hits back at you, which you wouldn't do if you weren't appetizable. So that K factor is tremendously important. Now remember, the ultimate initiative is always in the non-identified field, which religious people call God, because actually it is absolute good. And the word God means absolute good. Now, it is infinitely intelligent, infinitely sentient, infinitely powerful, and infinitely present. There is nowhere where that energy is not. And the totality of knowledge is possessed, where every identified being within it is in the possession of that infinite field. So that really is an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent God. It's no good pretending it hasn't got personality like we've got. Whatever we've got is a modality of it. Right? It's quite legitimate to pray, if you understand that prayer means work, to the infinite sentient power to lead you from ignorance to knowledge, from darkness to light, from time to eternity, like all the great prayer books say. You are praying to become more intelligent, means you are working to understand the ultimate nature of sentient power. Now that infinite sentient power has got all the data that we as individuals have available within it, because we are modalities of it. And it has the initiative. So it can make a decision at any moment to wind up the whole process of manifestation and push it into pralaya. Manifestation in manu antara. That means countings, appetival, latching on, and a law, a product of appetite latching on to things. The Torah is the rota, the repetition created by identification, which makes you do the same thing over and over again. In psychology, you have a law called the persistence of error. Why does error persist? Answer, you latched on appetitively to something and you haven't let go yet. You don't see why. Why can't we all of us, considering we are all modalities of one field now, consciously and deliberately confer upon each other all the things we know, all the knowledge we've got, all the tricks we know? I appeal to you again, Peter, as a businessman. Are you prepared to turn over all your information to rival manufacturers about sources, prices, etc.?
Why should I?
Why should you? I could give you a very good reason. Well, of course, private purpose, hang on. He says, why should I? I thought that was a serious question. Why should I? Well, if you could, which you can't, but if you could, you know what
well,
you do?
Well, if I did,
yeah.
it would be a breaking of identification of the knowledge that I thought I had, mm-hmm. and I thought they didn't have, and they really did have.
Yeah.
So it would be really talking to myself. So
yes.
And in turn, I might get something back anyway.
You might. What you actually get back, if you could do it, would be you'd be released from a relatively low level of business and be freed with your energy and intelligence for a higher level of business. But you have to make a leap of faith. And you can't make a leap of faith in a state of egoic identification. So, insofar as we are identified with the inside curve of the snake, we are therefore egoic on that side. We believe that we can only survive by this process of keeping our information to ourselves. And on the inside of the curve, the energy tends to rotate. So instead of an undulating world, which is Ananda bliss, you have a world of discrete psychons, monads, individuals, like Leibniz's monads, non-communicative, windowless, knowing nothing about each other, and plotting all the time to discover by external techniques what it is that everybody else knows and has got that you haven't. But it's only your closure that keeps you from getting it. Horrible, isn't it? Right. The initiative and the winding up moment when the Manu Antara goes into pralaya, when suddenly you go from ectropy, which is egoic identification, to entropy, removal of the identification, is determined by the field itself. And that's why when somebody said to Jesus, when is the last day, the last judgment? He said, no one knows that. The Father has kept that one for himself. That means then that the infinite sentient field power will decide when it will, if it will, without bothering to consider whether we like it or not. So supposing, after that wonderful Armageddon, we've all suddenly become aware of our interrelation to the point where we can hardly move, and we're suspended between Deb's delight that everybody knows everything about everybody, and Gertrude's on guard, everybody might know about me. Yeah, suspended there. And suddenly, entropy, paralyzed, put out. Now the energy is there, but now it's no longer mobile in a time sequence. It's stuck with the contemplation of its last orientation of the will at the moment the machinery stopped. It's just a very harsh thing there. For that moment, let him that stinks, stink still. He's rather rough, isn't it? You know, I'm covered all over with brute. And God winds it up. Caught. And this can actually happen. Why did it make you go like this?
Well,
you know that's a phallic member, don't you?
Thought about really the shallowness maybe of your existence.
You might be stuck with an idea that you had a shallow existence. Well, supposing you were a creature amphibian, well, used to shallow water.
Well, then that's even an identification.
Of course it is.
So therefore you'd have a true assessment of that day.
Yes. You could, if you could break identification, release yourself and say, quite a series of interesting errors. But the errors, felix culpa, you know, happy error, they educate me. Every error educates us and makes us more and more refined. But we can't make errors on purpose. Then we have to wait to make them to get more refined. That's how people go about looking for temptation. And they know they can't do it themselves. Right. Now, in that paralaya, in that entropy, that lying down of the energy, nothing is going on. There's a state similar to the state in deep, dreamless sleep. You are looking at, contemplating, and rearranging by acts of awareness, not physical acts of awareness, what you might have done if you had have done that would have been better than what you did do. And everybody's like that, in that paralaya. Now, as they're all busily doing this in the entropy state, what is the generalized state of that paralytic field? What does it feel like?
Chaotic.
And it's full of moanings and groanings and all. And corners where they have programs like Sunday morning television, titled This is the Lord's Day. And have you got a candle and a bun and a book with you for the symbolic act? This is happening throughout infinity. Can you imagine it? I will now quote to you. Last year, said a lady, I became converted to Christianity. This so devastated my husband, he's left. This is one of a serious requests for prayer. Please pray for me. You know, my little boy got his leg crushed and we told him he'd never walk again. And we requested your prayers, and he has walked again. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Yes. I imagine in that prayer line, everybody's trying to reshuffle their lives. How good are they at it, considering their state of identification with their errors?
I shouldn't think they're at all.
They're not very good. But the infinite field of sentient power has the initiative. It can say, hey, you lot, you've battled enough, you've got nowhere, you're still as dim as ever you were. We're going to start again. You see, now, I'm going to wind up in a moment. I'm giving you exactly half a second to make your mind up. What's your governing concept now? And suddenly it starts rolling. Are you ready? Most people come into the world with the memories of a previous existence of their own and their ancestors, the totality of ancestors. So every new world is actually made out of the debris of prior universes. We come in loaded with rubbish. You know, there might be one or two good thoughts somewhere, if you could find them. But when you examine them, they're at least 95% is rubbish to every 5% of relatively acceptable content. So what are we going to do if we know this? Every day we are, during the day, awake, we hope. We are in this Manvantara state. At night we go into paralaya and rearrange ourselves for tomorrow. How many of us? Deliberately. Last thing at night, say, I'm going to go into paralaya now, sort myself out, and find a good concept to begin tomorrow morning with. New every morning is the sun. Do you do it? Do you do it every night? Huh?
Try.
Try. Yeah, good. That means three. Yeah. Think it, feel it, will it. How many people do you think really do it? I mean, this is religious rite. Every night. I'm going to let you into a secret. I do it.
Very few do.
Very few do. Really. Because it's very hard to remember to do it. So what do you have in the bed to remind you? You know what I have? A hand grenade from the 1914-18. Anything to make the bed uncomfortable. Crumbs are quite useful. You know, eating a hard crust in bed. And you'd be surprised how that everybody's really a princess able to feel a peat through 19 eiderdowns. Aren't they? Have you noticed how big crumbs are in bed? It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, they're out to warm for 14. What the devil's that rock in the bed for? You can't find it, so you roll back. And you open them for a little time. And then you've got three pyjamas. Actually, it's your field sensitivity increasing as you break identification with the external stimulus situation. So when you're in the very deepest, deepest dreamless sleep, do you know where you are in relation to other people? Dream sharing. You don't dream alone. You don't dream in isolation. Your energy, your sentient power, is vibrating in everybody throughout the whole universe. And you're swapping dream elements. And according to the way your appetite moves to choose this, that or the other, do you know you're laying the foundation of a possible meeting with a person you've never met physically, but you're forming contacts in your dreams. Ah, I see a beautiful red-headed, long-legged, etc., etc., etc. in your dreams. Somewhere there is one. And it creates a line of least resistance. She has a row with the boss immediately. She gives her her job. She leaves, she goes to Warrington for some reason. You have a car accident on the road, She stops her car to help, and you have met. I've known one or two ladies that managed to get themselves banged out the bumper. Really, I made new relations. It's all to do with stupefying feeling. But the initiative is in the infinite sentient field. Now, energy is either energy of initiative or of inertia. If you identify, it's inertia. The ball rolls, and your identification carries you with it. So in order to become a being of initiative, you have to break identification. Now, how do you do it? You need a leap of faith. Why? When the snake bends, the outside of it is attenuated and feels less being relative to the inside of the curve, which means more egoic being. So it's more intense, yes, on the inside of the curve, and extense on the outside of the curve. And when you're looking for identification, you prefer the inside to the outside, don't you? Well, that preference has got to cease. And you have to see the ultimate logic of it. As long as that preference is there, you are finiting your consciousness. So you have to move to the outside of the curve first and say, I'm going to dare to let myself attenuate to the nth degree. I'm going to allow myself to become nothing whatever. That's called mystery of the annihilation of the self, Fana, F-A-N-A. You know, Fan is a word meaning straw, that which blows away, chaff. When you're winnowing the corn, you have a wind blowing and you throw it up in the air, and the lighter parts of the husks have blown away, and that leaves you with the grain to eat. And when you can allow everything that's been accreted to you from the outside to blow away in the wind. And remember what Jesus said about God. God is spirit, he says. And you don't know where it's come from. You don't know where it's going to. You hear the sound thereof now, only now. In other words, it's immediacy, now awareness, that you are factually, by appetival identification, reduced in being, not increased. And when you suddenly realize that the identification with existential being in the body is a reduction of power, a reduction of intelligence, then you do the metanoia, you turn upside down. You say, I don't want that reduction. What I want is the ultimate that caused the reduction. I'm not going to be superior because I'm going to include the inside of the curve and the outside, and that which precipitated and interpreted both. Can we see how simple that is logically? Ultimate reality is infinite sentient power. It undulates, and that makes it produce tension on the inside, extension on the outside, egoic awareness, jiva on the inside, atma on the outside. But they are both modalities of Brahman, the infinitely extended. Now you've never seen, no man has seen God at any time. You've never seen it as a finite egoic being, because your sense organs are evolved for looking at finite. But the infinite has form. Name me your form. Everyone's form. The form of everything, whatever. Mineral, vegetable, animal, human, angelic. All those forms are his forms. H-I-S, yes. His. When you write wisdom, you should really write it with an aspirated W. It's wisdom. When you become aware of that, you become aware of a hierarchy. That is a differentiation of powers, but you do not identify with superior power or inferior power, but power, sentient power, as such. You do not tie yourself down, nor tie yourself up. Now to do that, you have to have faith. What is faith? We've defined it before. Faith is the capacity for putting your foot down where no thing is, and in the act of putting it down, posit something to put it on. Yeah? That's faith. That word faith and the word path are the same word. You create the path by putting your foot down. Chesterton said, the rolling English trunk had made the rolling English ropes. As he wandered through the fields, he squashed the grass down. The next trunk said, Sammy's already prepared a path for him. And so he tramples it. The grass wears out. He now got a pathway. It was made by a non-intellectual, by a drunk. It was made by, not by a developed intellect, but by the undulation of absolute power. That's why rivers meander, don't they? They don't go straight down the landscape, do they? They go like this. And sometimes they make bow lakes and isolate little islands, don't they? Those are alienated ego structures of the river. An identified human being is exactly like that. Now, to make this leap of faith, we have to be aware that sentient power is the ultimate reality and is utterly indestructible and eternal and formal. It's formal. You tend to think, through abstract intellection, that the infinite is void of form, don't you? It's not. It's full of form. Our form. A mineral form, vegetable, animal, human, angelic, spiritual, super form, soul form. There's no such thing as nothingness in the negative sense. There are no negatives, there are only positives. And if you do that, you could actually do a spontaneous act of generosity. Could you believe in the field? Cast your bread upon the water and it will return after many days. And it may not be much. And if it is much, sell it for chicken food. Because it's energy, it's marketable. Now, if you've got that much faith, so that you can actually afford a generous act without any hope of return, knowing perfectly well you don't need hope of return because there won't be a return without your hope. How do you feel about that condition? A wonderful, marvelous condition where you're so saturated with awareness of the reality of infinite sentient power with yourself as a modality of it, a form of it, no nothingness anywhere, because the sentient power is a formulating power. And it's a hierarchical power. And the more you accept that fact, the more you move up the hierarchy of awareness. Because, you know, the more aware you are of things, the more bargaining power you have. The more power of relation you have. All is a question of increased awareness. At the top level, absolute sentient power, you're aware that everything is everything else. It's not Aristotelian logic. An apple is an apple, not an orange. An apple is an orange, and a pig, and an elephant. It's all kind of things. Simultaneously, and then the identification pins it down. So in that entropy, that paralia, when you get in it at night, deliberately scan over the day. The yogic method is do it backwards. It's quite effective, it's helpful. When you get in bed, run your life backwards to before you got in bed. What you doing before that, before that, before that. Remember your day backwards. The reason why that is helpful, if you remember it forward, you increase your inertia. If you remember it backward, you undo your inertia. Because when you remember backwards, you see the cause of the effect. You start with the effect and look at the cause. And then you look at that cause as an effect of a previous cause, and you come back to the will. The absolute will is the cause. Now it's quite correct to say this. A man is a man. I'm including woman in this, wolf man. A man is a man in so far and no further then he has a good will to formulate, yes, and good will to formulate and function. Man means to evaluate, to create values. It's like a Nietzschean philosophy. Man is a creative sentient power. If you accept that and say, I am going to accept total responsibility for my own creativity as the absolute in the place where I am. If the Bishop of Durham can do it, I can do it. He's not that much smarter, he's just better read than some people.
Turn around.
That's metanoia. Turn around.
And look back at what's happened.
That's right.
Nobody ever knows what's happened.
It's not been made yet, has it?
When the morning comes in and you step out and then go
that's
forward
right.
again.
So if, yes. again. So if you put your grenade in the bed to remind you to make a note to remember backwards, you'd be surprised how it undoes your inertia. And when you break inertia, you're moving upwards from the ego-identified inside curve to the outside curve and then to the extension of the Brahman, where you are moving continuously towards omniscience. Very helpful. You do not get your teeth into it because of Samson's riddle. You remember, out of the eater came forth meat. Out of strength, sweetness. Now the eater is the infinite absolute sentient power itself. You are the meat. Now gracefully give yourself up. Put yourself on the dinner plate and say, Lord, I'm about to reverse that great sacrifice. You have laid down your cosmic life than we individually might be. So I'm going to lay down my life on the plate. And you can eat. And when you've eaten me, I'll be where I was before creation. Because you cannot have a formless power. FFF, triple F. Force, form, function. There is no force that does not form functions. There is no form that is not a force functioning. There is no function other than a force forming. It's an unbreakable trinity. And it is attainable in this life. Yeah? There's even a technical term meaning free in life. That's Jivan Mukti. You can become a being who, although in this life, in a physical body, through non-identification with particulars, and remembering of your infinite source of which you are a modality. You don't fall into identification, but you gain by everything you give up. So from the egotistic point of view, you practice kenosis. That means emptying of all the temporarily acquired knowledges that you have, and you give those knowledges up to the place they came from, where in their totality they are cosmic wisdom. Wisdom is the simultaneous presentation of all knowledges. A knowledge is an abstraction from infinite wisdom. How do you feel if you say that's a possibility? I'll have to fight inertias because they exist. But I will deliberately remember and know this. The essential man, the evaluator, is the will, not the intellect. The essential man is the will. You haven't to think about what you're thinking to see what you're going to do. You have to get hold of you as the will zone, determining by will what you will choose to intellectualize. The intellect is posterior ontologically to the will. So you have to have a good will. So in all situations, you ask yourself in a relation, when you're making a relation or breaking a relation, is my will a good will? And remember, good or as they say in Manx, and good. The G-double-O means the will, it means that which goes, that which initiates motion, and the D is the definition. Good means that you define a goal. And it must be a goal that's constructive and helpful to an infinity of beings. And if you can say truthfully to yourself that your will is to benefit all beings whatever that come within your orbit, then you are essentially good. Your essence is good. There is a Latin little word, ENS. What does it mean? Pardon? Being. Yeah, but it's a bit smarter than that. The letter B means circumscribed, but ENS doesn't mean that. It means threefold, that's fourth form function, relative motion, issuance. ENS. It isn't bound like the letter B. Being and wishing to be a being is egotism. To be ENS is to be aware that you feel, that you will and think as an indivisible trine process. Now, can you affirm yourself as that and watch yourself so constantly with such sharpness you actually know whether your will is to destroy a relation or to create it? You know, in other words, your fundamental essential motive. Now, if you do that, you become a magnet. You know that person, magnetism, things like that is nothing but unity of will. The moment you unify the will, you stop the scattering process of the will. Scattering is identification with plurality. Now, you all know enough about elementary magnetism to know that a bar of iron can, under certain conditions, attract into bits of iron, can't it? And you call it a magnet. Magnet means marg, appetite, condensed, net, you see? So, a net of appetite, condensed, is a magnet. Now, every bar of iron, which is not a magnet, and doesn't pick up other bits of iron, is not a magnet, only for one reason. All the constituent molecules of it are higgledy-piggledy. They haven't got one goal. But if you run a certain current through them, you can line them up. You've added nothing except orientation.
One is order and the other is chaos.
One is order and the other is chaos. Now, when you have one goal and one only goal, you are a magnet, and everything you could possibly need for your good will come to you. And if you allow yourself to be pluralized by contingent external stimuli, your magnetism is self-contradictory. And at the moment, a young fellow who is torn between these words, living here or in Australia. No, he's torn between. It's a long distance from between torn. And he's really worried, is his future here or there? Will he become famous here or there? Are they easy to dupe here or there? I think they're the same everywhere. It's not those places, but you, in your inner orientation that determines the unity or plurality, the magnetism or lack of it in yourself. What do you do about that? If you know that's true, and you must know it's true if you think about it, the moment you converge upon a given goal with 100% interest, your interest captures the interest of other people. I was having a nibble and something, and I switched down, and it was Pebble Mill last week. And there was a woman there, she'd got no side, no cheek, and she was doing an embroidery program. And she got some thing like cling film. And she used it like a fabric to do embroidery on. and she embroidered in lovely patterns, beautifully designed and very well chosen in colour. And when she'd done all this embroidery, tied it together with her machine, she put this thing in water, and the film that she'd embroidered on was soluble, and she took out the embroidery. Do you know how many requests they had for her book? They were astonished. 70,000 letters. A nice, quiet woman. No side, no bustling, no boasting. She just did something wonderfully efficiently, with very good taste and total convergence. And they were actually saying, good God, 70,000. How did they feel about opening 70,000 letters? That woman's a magnet for one reason. She loved what she was doing. She converged, she had unity of will. Now if you want to be a magnet, that's the way to get it. If you don't want to be a magnet, you could have two reasons, one good and one bad. What's the good reason for being a magnet? Yeah, what good is that?
You feel some sort of order out of the chaos.
What's the good of the order out of the chaos?
Feel it essential.
Essential. In a sense. Could be. If you know what you mean. It could have another reason. If you allow yourself to disintegrate, you know what you are to other people. A pest. Really? You could actually have a very good reason for your personal integration, namely removal of pestiferous behavior from other people, out of sheer compassion. That's what Buddha had. Not many of his followers got it. They were squabbling almost immediately after his death. Just see who'd got it best. And the same thing happened to the other religions. Same thing happened in Christianity. They actually were killing each other over doctrinal points. Who's got the truth of the truth of the truth best and most clearly? We'll have a debate. Well, I don't trust you, so I'm bringing in my club to the debate. A bit like a French parliament where you're throwing pots. Or a Spanish one where you bring guns. Not everybody is fit to go to a conference. Probably there's only one person in this country that should be in a conference of political importance. Mrs. Thatcher. And this morning, Hugo Young said about her, to explain her, and very kind, nice thing, full of compassion. He said, she's just self-righteous. She's really righteous. She's righteous, you know. And it's that righteousness that has made her unaware that all her cabinet members and advisors are wheeler-dealers. She's so righteous, she never noticed that they're wheeler-dealers. I thought that's the best defense I've heard of her. And therefore, he said, she's bound to make a comeback, because once people realize how righteous she is, they want to back. So I'm going to vote for her. With a cross. And I will mean when I put it on, it's a kiss for Maggie. We had enough at the moment. Thank you.